Life will soon get back to something closer to normal. But there is something undeniably haunting about this scene as well. It simply doesn't add up to the careful observer who is not swayed by the spell of a nostalgic fantasy. Where is the livestock for the clearly ample meat? Where are the people? This is the energy on which the story thrives and pushes forward. Nostalgia soon surrenders its seat to the reality of solastalgic comprehension. The world has changed. Terminus is far worse than a world of walkers. When Rick speaks in the dark of the cattle car, he rallies his friends by assuring them that the denizens of Terminus are screwing with the wrong people. Solastalgia, in other words, yields its seat to the rugged survivalist, the one we recognized in the nostalgic depiction of Rick as the lone horseman at the beginning of the series. Now, we have Rick's behavior in the new and more brutal world to bolster our optimism. New legends, new memories, and newly formed nostalgic tales will continue to carry our heroes forward. And for these reasons, we will continue to turn the pages of this ongoing and epic saga. 3. Inside the head of the Walking Dead, the neurobiology of Walker Dysfunction Disorder. E. Paul Zare and Stephanie Norman. Somewhere in all that organic wiring, all those ripples of light, is you, the thing that makes you unique and human. Dr. Edwin Jenner, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Sitting on your shoulders is the most complicated object in the known universe. Futurist Michio Kaku. Fans often ponder the physical reality of walkers in The Walking Dead. What could produce the features of movement that all walkers share? Clinical neuroscience offers some answers regarding the motor system in the human brain and spinal cord that could, if there really were a zombie virus, cause the changes in movement control that walkers show. Consider objectively how the walkers in the post-apocalyptic landscape of The Walking Dead move around. You can put together a differential diagnosis for Walker Dysfunction Disorder, in their world, not ours, that is based on what we see walkers do and what we know about the neural control of movement. The Dead Differential, a diagnosis for Walker Dysfunction Disorder. Imagine yourself as a member of the biomedical science team in the Office of Infectious Diseases at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC. In Atlanta, Georgia, while the emergence of walkers sweeps across the continent. Now, imagine seeing someone slowly shuffle into view around the corner of the hall leading to your basement laboratory. You can't yet see her face, but you must decide quickly. Is she a walker or a human ally? A differential diagnosis helps resolve this question. In addition to helping you solve the biological puzzle of the Walker Dysfunction Disorder, and what, if anything, you can do about it, this diagnosis helps you quickly determine whether you should lend a helping hand or reach for your weapon. The walkers are like us, but not. Walkers show no pain reactions, shuffle or amble slowly around, react slowly, lack integration and balance and posture, and have difficulty with coordination. In contrast to these weaknesses, they have almost superhuman grip strength. These observations are your first bits of information used to create a symptoms list. Extensive debriefing with Rick and the others, including asking about all the walkers they've encountered, would provide a huge amount of information and data on the range of things walkers have been observed doing. With your team at the CDC, you'd create a parallel list of the possible causes of these symptoms. If you worked in a flu pandemic scenario instead of a zombie apocalypse, your next step would be to list possible causes, sorting them from most to least urgent and health-threatening. Of course, this isn't so relevant to you. Despite what Dr. Herschel Green may have thought about the family he kept alive in his barn, your patients are walkers who are already dead. You aren't worried about their overall health anymore. Instead, you're using the differential diagnosis to, one, make sure that woman shuffling into your office is in fact a walker before raising your weapon, and two, figure out which parts of her brain are affected so that you can create a cure. excluding and ruling out the items on the possible causes list by using tests, observations, and available information, brings you to the solution and results. The nervous system is a pretty complex place. You've got about 100 billion nerve cells, neurons, in your brain, and another 7 billion in your spinal cord. Each of those neurons has thousands of connections, synapses, from other neurons on it. That network of over 100 trillion connections produces a lot of overlap between possible causes of symptoms and the related neural structures. Regardless, you'd work through the symptoms, assess the likelihood of each nervous structure involved, and determine which Walker-like deficits could be produced by alterations to these areas. Table 1. Differential Diagnosis for Walker Dysfunction Disorder. For more on neuroanatomy and neurophysiology, see Principles of Neural Science. Symptoms: reduced postural and balance reactions. Neural structures: frontal cortex, cerebellum, basal ganglia, brainstem, spinal cord. Possible causes: cerebellar disorders, Parkinson's disease, multiple sclerosis, concussion. Reduced connection between head and eye movement, vestibulo-ocular reflex. Cerebellum, frontal cortex, brainstem. Cerebellar disorders, concussion. Slowed movement speed, basal ganglia, spinal cord, neuromuscular junction. Parkinson's disease, myasthenia gravis. Exaggerated deficits on one side of the body, basal ganglia, cortical and subcortical regions, spinal cord. Stroke, spinal cord injury, Parkinson's disease. Slowed walking speed, motor cortex, basal ganglia, brainstem, spinal cord. Stroke, spinal cord injury, Parkinson's disease, concussion. Decreased pain reactions, spinal cord, somatosensory cortex. Congenital insensitivity to pain. Resistance to movement, rigidity, basal ganglia, spinal cord. Parkinson's disease, multiple sclerosis. Sustained muscle contractions, spinal cord. Tetanus infection, strychnine poisoning. Speech production, frontal cortex, Broca's area. Stroke, traumatic brain injury. Evaluating the DEAD differential. Pain in the limbs. Pain starts at the skin with receptors that detect imminent tissue damage, nociception. Problems with the perception of pain can be due to a lack of receptors in the skin, very high levels of neurotransmitters, for example serotonin and norepinephrine, that block transmission in the spinal cord, and a failure of the nervous system to integrate signals from the receptors. This happens in a condition so rare that fewer than 100 cases have been reported in the medical literature, congenital insensitivity to pain. People with this condition are unable to sense warning signals of impending tissue damage. The neurons that should bring information about tissue damage to the spinal cord and up to the brain are working, but the processing of those signals and interpretation as pain isn't happening. It's a very dangerous thing, because pain guides our behaviors in avoiding certain things. When Michonne goes all Miyamoto Musashi while lopping limbs off walkers with her katana sword, the walkers don't even respond to what should be hugely painful cuts. They just keep coming to meet their doom, or, more truly, their merciful release. It remains unclear whether this problem walkers have with sensing pain is due to deficits in detection, by receptors in the skin, transmission, via spinal cord, or perception, in the cerebral cortex. Muscle contraction. Walkers seem to have great grabbing strength. This indicates that the walker's central nervous system, CNS, the brain and spinal cord, has trouble getting the muscles to contract gradually and relax properly. Spinal cord. Your spinal cord's motor neurons, nerve cells that signal muscles to move, turn themselves off as fast as they are turned on. When these motor neurons activate to contract a muscle, they simultaneously turn on other neurons that loop back directly to them and shut them down. This might seem odd, but isn't that the reason Michonne can carefully reach, draw, and cut with her katana? Without it, she'd move like a walker with uncontrolled and sustained muscle contractions and an inability to strike with precision. The walker's tetonic contractions are hallmarks of botulism toxin poisoning, leading to the medical condition tetanus. The tetanus vaccination you get, and that one hopes Rick and the other survivors have access to, helps protect you against Clostridium tetani, a type of bacteria found in soil that typically enters the body through a wound such as a cut or a bite. The bacterium reproduces rapidly in the body and makes its way to the connection between motor neurons and muscle fibers. Once attached to the end of a motor neuron in a muscle, C. tetani climbs up into the spinal cord and blocks the effects of a neurotransmitter that helps regulate the command for muscle contraction in the spinal cord. In clinical tetanus, sustained and powerful involuntary muscle contractions occur. The poison strychnine does something similar. Since muscles can't keep contracting forever with no relaxation, respiratory muscle failure eventually leads to death in about 40% of tetanus cases. Spinal cord injury and multiple sclerosis are also clinical conditions that could produce some of the deficits seen in walkers. Incomplete spinal cord injuries, those with some sensory and motor commands preserved and relayed from the spinal cord to the brain, can produce the one-sided weakness that many walkers have, but also often produce spastic muscle spasms during movement. Although one side often appears more affected in walkers, they don't seem to have spastic muscles. The autoimmune disorder multiple sclerosis involves weakening of the insulation around nerves, change. This degrades their ability to transmit information. The rapid onset of the changes seen in walkers, though, is too fast for the weeks to months cyclical changes often seen in multiple sclerosis. The major human behavior retained in walkers is, well, walking. As with other mammals, human brains and spinal cords coordinate our arms with our legs when we walk. Evolutionary conservation in these connections and in the basic circuits in the brain and spinal cord, called central pattern generators that regulate walking, are found in almost all species, spanning the swimming lamprey, the crustaceans, the cat, the non-human primates, all the way to our species, Homo sapiens. The walkers, just like the barnyard chicken running around with its head cut off, can move around, using their spinal cord mechanisms to do it. Cerebral cortex. Your cerebral cortex regulates almost all aspects of your movements. Its main role is controlling voluntary movement, that is, making your body do what you want it to do. When you make a decision to move, a relayed command arrives at the main motor output center of your brain, the primary motor cortex, signaling the spinal cord motor neurons to produce the commands to contract muscle. Damage to the primary motor cortex produces weakness in the muscles normally activated by the damaged areas. Weakness is not an obvious deficit for walkers, and so the walker's primary motor cortex, the direct motor output pathway from the brain, probably is not damaged extensively. Although limb strength and movement remain relatively intact in walkers, coordination of the arms and legs is affected. Damaging the supplementary motor area, SMA, the major brain area that helps coordinate the brain's left and right hemispheres, reduces coordination between the arms and legs, and movements therefore become compromised. Walkers make primitive speech-like sounds that can be pretty loud. This suggests they have partial ability to activate the brain's speech centers, but that those centers are not functioning normally. You'd suspect damage in a particular part of the frontal cortex called Broca's area, which often occurs after stroke, and results in the ability to make sounds but not form thoughts into words. Unlike after a stroke, it's unlikely that walkers have any thoughts they may be trying to express, despite the governor's best efforts to converse with his zombified daughter, Penny, during feeding times. Walkers lose the smooth, effortless control found in human locomotion. Instead, they show similarities in the motor control deficits seen after cerebrovascular accidents and incomplete spinal cord injuries. It seems that some parts of the connections that coordinate the arms and legs remain active in walkers, but are quite rudimentary. Many walkers have an obvious deficit in which one side of the body is more affected than the other. This is a common outcome in stroke, in which damage to the brain's neurons is usually more concentrated on one side, producing larger deficits on the opposite side of the body. Cerebellum. The cerebellum is tucked up at the back of the brain, just underneath the cerebral cortex. If the cerebral cortex is Veronica, the cerebellum is Betty. The cerebellum is less flashy and a bit hidden, but is home to a staggering 50% of the brain's neurons, more than the cerebral cortex itself. As with other brain regions, neurons in the cerebellum are organized in very specific patterns. The cerebellum regulates movement indirectly by adjusting the output of the descending motor systems of the brain. This brain region is also critically important for learning and performing skilled movements. The cerebellum has three functional regions, with distinct inputs and outputs related to balance. 1. Regulation and integration of eye and head movements. 2. Control of limb movement. And 3. Movement planning. The critical piece here in your assessment of Walker dysfunction disorder, while working under great pressure at a rapidly deteriorating biocontainment lab in the CDC, is that injury to different areas of the cerebellum produces different symptoms. The terrible balance, staggered walking, impaired coordination, and overly tense muscles that Walker's display could all be attributed to changes in the cerebellum, making it a major candidate for a region affected in Walker dysfunction disorder. Basal ganglia. The basal ganglia are a collection of neurons important for coordinating movement. As with the cerebellum, most of the initial information about what the basal ganglia do was deducted by researchers who correlated clinical observations in life to post-mortem anatomical measurements of brains in conditions such as Parkinson's disease. The basal ganglia help start movement and balance the ability to produce movement against expression of unwanted movement. In the neurodegenerative disorder known as Parkinson's disease, after James Parkinson, 1755 to 1824, shaking palsy or tremor occurs at rest and is related to slowness of movement, lack of facial expression, lack of balance reactions, shuffling gait, and generalized stiffness or rigidity of limb muscles. As the disease progresses, movement becomes more and more difficult. In contrast, degeneration in other sections of the basal ganglia can lead to excessive and involuntary movement of the limbs. In early-stage Huntington's disease, uncontrolled limb movements, dystonia, excess muscle activity occurs, cognitive decline and dementia are found. Taken together, disorders of the basal ganglia have huge impacts on movement control, but are also dominant diseases of cognition and thought. Walkers show some aspects of basal ganglia disorders, specifically related to rigidity, lack of facial expressions, and lack of balance. Walkers also exhibit involuntary limb movements superimposed on their other deficits. An example is when they lined up at the prison fence line and snarled at everyone while shuffling around and waving their limbs. The basal ganglia are probably an important candidate location for dysfunction in walkers. Zombiform rhabdoviridae. What causes the symptoms present in the walkers? The most likely options are an autoimmune reaction or a virus. Let's say it's a virus, zombiform rhabdoviridae, if you will, a good working name if only because the infection has similarities with rabies. The virus would have two separate but parallel modes of infection, latent and bite. Latent, activated after death of the host and expression of the walker characteristics, occurring in a variable timeline. Bite, activated upon biting. Rapid immune system activation accelerates onset and severity of symptoms. Dale in the comic book, or Bob on TV, reveals to cannibals eating his leg that he has been infected by bite and is tainted meat. In his body, zombiform rhabdoviridae hijacks the fast form of cellular transport and moves steadily up sensory axons from the site of the bite into the spinal cord at a rate of 4 centimeters a day. You would almost guess that Glenn and Rick knew about this rapid pace when they amputated Herschel's leg after a walker bit his calf. Dale or Bob's symptoms appear faster than this, so there must be additional factors such as bacterial infection or complications from his wound. The zombiform rhabdoviridae virus continues to invade the nervous system, jumping from the motor neurons in the spinal cord to the descending connections from the brain that normally activate them. In another 24 to 48 hours, the virus should arrive at the primary motor cortex, the main motor output center in the brain, and then spread to other areas of the brain. the infected bite side, experiences more cell death on the same side of the brain. Because Dale or Bob was bitten on his right shoulder, the right side of his brain will experience more damage. We are spared seeing him suffer fully these effects of Walker dysfunction disorder by the merciful actions of a distraught friend. Wrapping up Walker dysfunction disorder. Whatever virus or other factor might be causing the deficits in Walker's, it has effects from the muscle level all the way up to all the motor control regions in the brain. This suggests a widespread and systemically diffuse underlying cause, leading to the presentation of Walker-like characteristics. Our final conclusion is that, as with many neurological conditions, symptoms in Walker's cannot be uniquely assigned to one region or specific neurological deficit. Instead, in Walker dysfunction disorder, the major constellation of effects that Walker's express comes from something affecting all the motor control regions of the brain very diffusely. It should not be surprising, then, that the only sure way to stop the threat of Walker's is to damage the brain itself. The extensive brain alterations, cortex, basal ganglia, and cerebellum, and problems with controlling muscle contraction and relaxation explain why Walker's can only walk and not run. The transition from walking to running is a more conscious decision that depends on the intact function of the human nervous system, which has been changed dramatically in Walker's. These alterations also explain why Walker's are unable to perform complex sequences of movements. You don't see Walker's performing skilled actions and limb movements, such as those found in dance, parkour, or karate, even if the Walker's were experts at performing them before reanimation. This is probably a good thing. There is already enough thrills, tension, and drama watching The Walking Dead unfold on the small screen, or reading the black and white pages of the graphic novel, without adding reanimated, black belt, base jumping, NASCAR driving ninja Walker's to the mix. 4. Masculinity Narratives in the Post-Apocalypse. Alan Kistler and Billy San Juan. We'll be okay, because this is how we survive. Rick Grimes. We each have a story inside us. This story is the culmination of values and worldviews we've encountered since birth. As we grow, we absorb ideals that narrate the very existence we live. For males, a large part of the narrative deals with masculinity. Fathers pass on these narratives unknowingly, often through actions and decisions, rather than as a didactic lesson. Men are taught to be tough. Men are taught to be strong. Men are taught to be providers and defenders. The narrative constantly bombards boys to create an operating system. Transmission of the male narrative. Men impart the masculine narrative through several methods, including a series of punishments and rewards provided by several sources, including parents, friends, and media. The reinforcement, rewards, for man behaviors range from external to internal, singular to continued, physical to social. The reinforcements that transmit the male narrative may be glaringly overt. For example, a most valuable player award on a sports team celebrates the masculine traits of physical fitness, leadership, and perseverance. The transmission also occurs on a subtle level, such as a kind word from a father figure, which implies love and belonging. Either way, the narrative is passed from one male to another at all ages. These narrative transmissions are apparent in The Walking Dead. Carl Grimes resists his mother's attempts to care for him in simple ways, such as giving him a haircut. Shane Walsh, assuming a father-like role with Carl, tells the boy that going along with his mother's wishes not only will prove his character, but will result in a reward. You just get through this with some manly dignity, and tomorrow I'll teach you something special. In this moment, Carl receives reinforcement of masculine behavior. His budding narrative now includes the idea that a stoic attitude, manly dignity during an uncomfortable time, haircut, provides a reward, something special. When Carl later wants to stay on the green farm, Shane explains that helping with chores will increase his chances of earning respect and help from Herschel Green's family, who might allow them to stay. Thus, we have another reinforcement of masculine behavior. Carl learns from a man that physical labor leads to a home and safety. Carl later begins to exhibit bouts of rebellion. The rebellion is a sign that he is eager to act on the narratives he has learned, despite lacking the maturity to do so. His strong desire to help the group even jeopardizes his safety, such as searching for Sophia and taking weapons off a dead body that could be a walker. Despite his transgressions, Carl's biological father, Rick Grimes, understands that the boy is motivated to protect and is trying to apply the lessons he's learning from his mentors. They begin shooting lessons, and the boy's maturing behavior, along with the progress he shows in learning how to survive, earns him the privilege of joining the adults on their supply runs and raids on walker-inhabited houses. Carl's adolescence, though occurring in a post-apocalyptic dystopia, becomes a testament to the lasting nature of the narrative through generations. The way a male narrative morphs when passed intergenerationally depends on several factors. Shane gave Carl pragmatic reasons and rewards for good behavior. Rick attempts to pass on wisdom to his son by pointing out that being a man means not only displaying strength, but also using restraint. Specifically, considering the feelings of others before voicing an opinion that may cause them distress. Rick explains that such behavior has moral value because it is right to care about others. He later speaks to Carl about how his own father taught him profound things about the world and how to live in it, but regrets that simply repeating such lessons isn't good enough in a post-apocalyptic earth. Rick admits he must adjust his own teachings. No more kid stuff. I wish you could have the childhood I had, but that's not going to happen. The narrative shifts. A value adaptive for civilization is abandoned because of its vestigial quality in the current world. Normative male alexithymia. A fascinating aspect of the masculine narrative is the tendency toward a phenomenon known as alexithymia, the inability to identify or describe emotion. Adult males are not immune to emotion, just the opposite. They feel emotions as strongly as anyone else, whatever age or gender. Unfortunately, in traditional patriarchal societies, they are not often allowed or encouraged to develop the language or capacity to express it. Expression of emotions other than anger and a select few others is seen as weakness that merits punishment. Playgrounds, schoolyards, and households set the scene for this narrative. Male culture teaches young boys that the expression of emotions is a direct contradiction of manliness, with phrases such as, "boys don't cry," "man up," "don't be a sissy," and "grow a pair." Boys are labeled as crybabies if they show sadness or frustration. Meanwhile, it is accepted that girls cry. This sexist dichotomy inhibits healthy emotional development through the expectations of the male gender. Alexithymia is much like lie. Ignoring emotions can be useful in certain situations, dangerous in others. In the context of masculinity, alexithymia is highly adaptive in the social role men have traditionally taken. When Sophia goes missing, Carl is determined to find her, even though others have concluded that she must be dead. Eventually, Sophia is revealed as a walker. Carl cries in his mother's arms as the innocence of his youth betrays him. He then watches as his father shoots Sophia down, effectively shooting the hope Carl had hung on to. In this scene, we notice a dichotomy. The young Carl, whose masculine ideals are still fresh, has not yet fully succumbed to a numbness of feeling. Meanwhile, his older, masculine father suppresses his emotion while taking pragmatic action. Carl later assures himself, affirming his father's actions by stating that he would have done the same thing. At this point, Lori worries about the boy's disconnect from emotion. This episode shows the progression of alexithymia in a dramatic fashion, but it provides an example of the process by which it occurs. When Lori is on the verge of becoming a walker, Carl dons the mantle of masculinity and kills her. He arrives at the decision rationally, with emotions playing little part in it. His father cries upon the discovery of Lori's death, yet Carl simply bows his head with little more than a frown. He has embraced the masculine narrative or, rather, the masculine narrative has embraced him. These examples show that shutting down emotional pathways in specific situations is adaptive in areas related to masculinity. However, failing to explore and process the numbed emotions may cause adverse effects. Rick's inability to grieve properly for his dead wife leads to psychotic episodes. Yet he keeps the hallucinations secret and adheres to the value of stoicism in men. He forces the illusion of mental stability, conforming to the idea that the alpha male's mind is sound. The same strict adherence to masculine norms causes men to turn to maladaptive forms of emotional coping, such as drugs, alcohol, and thrill-seeking behaviors. Men as protectors. Knights, princes, kings, traditional gender roles dictate a man's pride in providing for his family. A rudimentary examination of media shows heroic males as protagonists, providers, and protectors. Father, brother, and husband characters act as de facto guardians. Countless B-movie reels flaunt men brandishing weapons, pitchforks, and torches, while the women and children cower behind them. These observations reflect a core narrative that men pass down to their children. The family relies on you. The Walking Dead perpetuates examples of the family guardian narrative. During Rick's coma, Shane Walsh puts himself in the position of proxy protector of his friend's family. It is later revealed that after Rick enters surgery for the injuries that lead to his coma, Shane assures Lori that she isn't alone. Shane then guards the family, mentoring Carl and loving Lori. His relief at Rick's return gets overshadowed by resentment over having Lori and Carl taken from him. Shane and Rick come to inevitable conflict concerning Rick's duties as husband and father. Shane concludes that Rick's moral values are antiquated for the modern, walker-infested world. He declares, "Rick, you can't just be the good guy and expect to live, okay? Not anymore." These disagreements with Rick culminate in Shane's attempt to kill his best friend. Shane's justification for murder stems from the belief that he is the better husband and father, and thus is entitled to resume those roles with Lori and Carl. A byproduct of this narrative is the trope, male hero gets the girl. The recurring theme in hero stories of a male protagonist enduring hardship in order to save a damsel plays into the masculine narrative. The damsel eventually falls in love with the man for his valiant actions and self-sacrifice, which serve as emotional and sexual reinforcement. The narrative permeates countless fairy tales and movies and is reinforced by everyday language. Phrases such as, "he won me over," and "he swept me off my feet," imply an active male role and a passive feminine role. The woman becomes a prize to obtain, the man's due, a ball that he must retrieve from an obstacle or opponent who guards it. As was mentioned before, a prime example of this value occurs in the story arc or love triangle of Shane, Rick, and Lori. Cognitive dissonance abounds between Shane's actions as hero and his inability to claim Lori as his own. The dissonance creates such negative feelings that he ultimately attempts to take the life of a person he once regarded as both his superior at work and his best friend. The Faces of Rick. Over the course of The Walking Dead, Rick Grimes goes through the ringer and back, changing as the situation requires it, and usually coming out each time a little more haggard and a little more bearded. Sheriff Rick. Rick Grimes starts off as a man of the law through and through. He asks for things such as gas and supplies. He's fair and noble and believes every life is worth trying to save. Rick Tater. If Sheriff Rick can't survive this world, he'll become the Rick Tater. He's in charge, making the tough decisions, and no one is allowed to question that. This isn't a democracy anymore. Red Rick. Losing Lori pushes Rick Tater off the diving board, belly flopping into a pool of molten rage. He only sees Red as he storms the tombs of the prison, killing dozens of walkers by himself, and as he repeatedly stabs the walker who ate Lori. Jack Torrance, The Shining, would be so proud. Crazy Rick. Rick crashes straight into Cray Cray Town, imagining phone calls from his dead pals and hallucinating angry Shane and judgmental Lori. No, crazy is not an appropriate psychological term, but that's how the characters come to see him. This is Rick at his most broken. No matter what he does, it just doesn't seem to be enough to keep the people he cares about alive. Farmer Rick. With some steady guidance from good old Herschel, Crazy Rick transitions from the depths of insanity into a more serene state. Farmer Rick no longer carries a gun. He eschews the stressors of leadership and buries his hands in soil instead. He won't even kill any of the walkers gathered at the fence. He's all about peace, love, and crops. Survivor Rick. The governor's final attack on the prison forces Survivor Rick to emerge. When the Claimers are about to rape Carl and murder Rick, Michonne, and Daryl, Claimer leader Joe asks Rick, "What the hell are you going to do now, sport?" Rick responds not with words, but by biting a chunk out of the dude's throat. Nothing good lasts in a world of zombies. Survivor Rick will hack, shoot, or maul anyone to protect the people he calls family. Citizen Rick. Rick's family reaches Alexandria. Soon, there's a new sheriff in town. After he shaves. Katrina Hill. Men as Action-Oriented. A review of masculinity-based theory and research found that a tenet of manhood is that masculinity requires public proof. A man must be seen being a man. This may explain the stereotype of a handyman, a perceived natural state in which adult males are proficient at carpentry, yard work, and household repairs, whereas those who do not show such skill are considered strange or weak. Men are expected to be doers, fixers. Men don't wait to react, they take control and actively solve situations. A man who waits is seen as indecisive, but a man who takes charge and provides, especially in spite of difficult circumstances, is to be revered and admired. At times, a man who embraces the narrative of action can attain almost godlike status. The governor repeatedly stresses that considering all one's options cannot override the need for action. The town of Woodbury looks to him for guidance. They trust him and look to him for leadership. He solves internal conflict, acting as both hero and father figure to the entire population. Other times, man becomes slave to this impulse. A prime example of the weakness caused by this narrative occurs when Rick, upon seeing Carl's prone and injured body, must be told several times to stay at his side. Rick knows that Carl needs his blood, but he cannot simply sit passively. He gets up several times, attempting to do something. It is in this moment that Rick's masculinity, normally adaptive, causes him great grief. He cannot bear to wait, watch, or worry. He must act. The male behaviors exhibited in The Walking Dead show that traditional masculine narratives, for better or worse, thrive in a post-apocalyptic world. However, the fact that males are given these messages at such a young age does not mean they are condemned to follow them. It is possible to take charge of fate and, as Rick Grimes does, embrace both masculinity and overall humanity. After all, a post-apocalyptic dystopian environment populated with zombies requires more than survival. It requires humanity to thrive. Case File 1. Shane Walsh. Travis Langley. I hadn't read the comic. I read the script, and I was completely blown away. I said, "Wow!" And then actually getting the job? Quadruple wow! And then reading the comic, I'm like, wait a second. Actor Joe Bernthal, regarding his surprise upon discovering Shane's comic book fate. After Shane Walsh becomes a father figure to Rick's son, a lover for Rick's wife, and a leader among the survivors they join outside Atlanta, Rick Grimes surprises them all by turning up alive. Shane's mixed feelings about Rick's return degenerate into resentment and anger, as Rick not only reclaims his family, but emerges as the new leader. Embittered and feeling that Rick has taken everything he had left in this dark new world, Shane tries to kill his lifelong friend. Is Shane evil? Attempting murder because he covets his brother's wife is an evil deed, biblically so. An action is not a whole person, though, and almost anyone is capable of doing wrong in certain circumstances. Calling a person evil means talking about enduring inner qualities. In psychology, we tend to avoid the word evil, even as we struggle to study it and give it technical names. Diagnosing evil, dark triad, dark tetrad. Some experts attempting to analyze evil view it in terms of the dark triad, a volatile combination of three overlapping sorts of selfishness. 1. Psychopathy, 2. Narcissism, and 3. Machiavellianism. Because a person can coldly exploit others without delighting in cruelty, the dark triad falls short of meeting the full criteria for malignant narcissism, the cruel kind of grandiose selfishness that the psychologist Eric Fromm dubbed the quintessence of evil. And so researchers began looking at sadism, delightedly hurting others, as a fourth component in a dark tetrad. Psychopathy. Psychopathy is a lifelong personality pattern high in fearlessness and insensitivity, low in empathy, inhibition, and remorse, and potentially dangerous to people in the psychopath's way. Chapter 11 in this book, It's the Humans You Have to Worry About, Becoming a Sociopath, distinguishes psychopathy from sociopathy, and details the two main sets of psychopathic qualities. Factor 1, made up of the interpersonal and emotional traits, for example, shallowness, remorselessness. And Factor 2, meaning antisocial actions and lifestyle, for example, impulsivity, lawbreaking. Factor 1 fits psychopathy as classically described by the psychiatrist Hervey Cleckley. And Factor 2 resembles the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders Diagnosis of Antisocial Personality Disorder. Despite considerable callousness and insufficient empathy, Shane is not a psychopath. He cares about the well-being of others, albeit those he likes and in an infantile way, and guilt gnaws at him. He has a conscience. His impulsivity and adolescent attitudes in the midst of relentless stress and danger get in the way of his hearing that conscience. He is arguably sociopathic, however, depending on which definition of sociopathy a diagnostician might apply. Even though he has not grown up as a psychopath, he resembles one many times. Apocalyptic circumstances have elicited evil he never showed before. Narcissism. Shane is selfish. Even his affection for others is largely self-serving. He places his interests first, as when he tries to force himself on an objecting Lori, even if he does back off, or when he later prioritizes his own yearnings over his best friend's life. Narcissism, vanity, overestimation of one's talents and importance, and excessive need for admiration can combine dangerously with psychopathy or sociopathy, producing an individual who is supremely selfish and cocksure, without emotional restraints to hold him or her back. Machiavellianism. Named for the 16th century diplomat Niccolò Machiavelli, Machiavellianism involves a calculating, manipulative attitude toward dealing with others, one that values cunning and deceit. Morality for cynical Machiavellians is pragmatic, based on instrumental, practical purposes. To them, ends justify means. After Shane deliberately wounds Otis and leaves the man for walkers to eat, distracting them so that he can escape with the medical equipment needed to save Carl's life, he lies about how Otis died. Later, Shane constructs a ruse to lead Rick into the woods, meaning to murder his best friend. Shane shows a Machiavellian attitude, but without great manipulative skill, he is a lousy liar. Inconsistencies in his stories keep exposing the truth, as does his own guilt. Sadism. Shane can be mean or insulting, a form of self-assertion that seems to empower him. When he pummels Carol's abusive husband into submission, saying, "I'll beat you to death, Ed," he keeps punching even after he renders Ed bloody and unconscious. He goes too far. He does not, however, continually seek opportunities to hurt others, or light up with glee over doing so. How evil? Even though Shane shows some features of every dimension of evil, he shows none consistently. His better qualities wane as ghastly circumstances bring out his worst. when goodness begins looking hazardously impractical. But he is neither an evil man before the apocalypse, nor the worst of people in the post-apocalypse, as the rest of these case files will show. Compared with most of our featured foes, Shane's a teddy bear. However we might imagine we'll act in an emergency, we really don't know until it happens. One person, having mentally rehearsed a disaster response, may react as he or she planned. One who has dreamed of saving the day might instead panic, whereas a cynic who scoffs at heroism, assuming that I'll never risk my neck for any stranger, in the heat of the moment sometimes does exactly that. When no plan is possible or when a crisis seems too unlikely to be anticipated, post-traumatic reactions can be especially severe. In the world of The Walking Dead, where nobody has ever seen a Living Dead film, no one expects the zombie apocalypse. Part 2. Responding. 5. Shock and Dread. What Fear Does to Humans. Dave Verhagen. In every calm and reasonable person there is a hidden second person, scared witless about death. Novelist Philip Roth. Only one way to keep you alive, Rick says to the frightened, freshly bitten Herschel Green. Rick lifts the axe and chops at Herschel's leg, blood splattering, until he hacks it completely off below the knee, not yet knowing if that will save Herschel from the effects of the walker's deadly bite. No other series, in comics or on television, evokes powerful emotions of fear, disgust, and sadness, often at the same moment, as strongly as The Walking Dead. Never before have we seen such a magnificent case study in popular culture, and what living in sustained, unrelenting fear and terror does to people. In The Walking Dead, we see how it affects decisions, relationships, and the integrity of the self. I've been starting to get afraid that it's easier just to be afraid. Beth Green. The biology of fear. Immediately after he has been bitten, we see Herschel's eyes, pure horror and panic. In that instant, his eyes, and ears and flesh and stimulated senses, send their information to his brain's thalamus, a mass of gray matter responsible for routing sensory information. Herschel reacts in milliseconds before he realizes what the threat actually is. That happens because his amygdala, a little almond-shaped mass of cells deep in the temporal lobe, processes sensory information and starts a behavioral response. Yell, pull away, seek safety, before the information reaches his brain's awareness centers. The thalamus sends information by two routes. The first route, directly telegraphed to the amygdala, is for lightning-fast reactions. The second route, relayed through the cerebral cortex, the outer wrinkled brain layer responsible for higher functions, allows the information to be processed and assigned a meaning. Does this pose a real threat? If the answer is yes, the amygdala generates the proper fight-or-flight response. This longer route allows for a smarter reaction even if the amygdala already is calling for action. Without the amygdala, we'd have been gobbled up by saber-toothed cats long ago. With it, we had a fighting chance long enough to develop a prefrontal cortex so that we could rule the earth. Sensory information floods in from the thalamus so that the amygdala, the command center for evaluating threats, can scan it for danger. When the amygdala recognizes a potential threat in the environment, it triggers a series of cascading alarms that produce what we see as overt signs of fear and panic. Racing heart, trembling, sweating, rapid breathing, blanching skin. These physical reactions serve the deep essential purpose of preparing us to defend ourselves vigorously. When it's lit up, the amygdala also jolts a portion of the cerebral cortex responsible for the conscious sensation of fear. At this point, the fear reaction isn't just a deeply visceral experience. It begins to take form in our consciousness. If the amygdala detects a potential threat, but the frontal cortex analyzes the report and finds it lacking, it tells the amygdala to calm down. In a world full of danger, the amygdala plays a vital role in keeping us safe. But an overactive amygdala kills our performance. We get tunnel vision. Our hearing becomes too selective, and our fine motor control falls apart. With more and more stress comes worse and worse fine motor behavior, the kinds of basic skills we need to lock doors, make phone calls, or grab for a weapon. In other words, many of the very things we might need to keep us safe in those terrifying moments when the zombies are closing in. Even worse than loss of fine motor skills, though, is the whammy high stress puts on decision-making. Our ability to make good choices can fall apart under extremely stressful, frightening situations. Whereas moderate stress can compromise decision-making, high stress can overwhelm us if our amygdala hijack our brains. One of the criticisms leveled at The Walking Dead is that the characters don't behave consistently. Their motivations and actions seem to shift. Tyrese, the man who becomes the main caretaker of the baby Lori delivered before dying, is a deeply compassionate man. Yet at one point he leaves baby Judith and two young girls to fend for themselves. "That's not how normal people behave," laments one journalist in his criticism of the show. "Especially people who go out of their way to protect others. It didn't make sense." Yet it did. Although unreliable character motivations are fair game for criticism of other stories, the lack of character stability is actually a strength of The Walking Dead. To suggest that there are ways in which normal people behave in the zombie apocalypse is to minimize the weight of the catastrophic stress they are experiencing. Thus, Rick is a rock and a pillar of strength, able to pick up the axe in a split second and cut off Herschel's leg in order to save him. But he hallucinates and makes shocking decisions at other times. Carol is meek and mild and trustworthy, but as we later learn, she is fully capable of murdering a child. It's not just that tough times call for tough decisions. It's that high stress can fundamentally alter people's way of acting, reacting, and even perceiving the world around them. Over the course of many long months of surviving the zombie outbreak, the humans of The Walking Dead go from rational to irrational and back. This is no Downton Abbey with clear character motivations. It's the freaking zombie apocalypse, and even the best of these people are a mess. To have any chance of survival in this nightmarish new world, their brains must maintain a delicate balance between the frontal cortex and the amygdala, with each part doing its share of the work, calming them when they need to be calmed, and activating them when they need to be activated. Rick at times finds that balance and is able to make the right but gruesomely tough choice. How is that possible? Because other processes are at work in his brain too. When we become afraid, we sometimes have the ability to think more clearly about the situation. This is due partly to the effects of a neurotransmitter called norepinephrine, a natural stimulant in the brain that increases neural efficiency, animating us and charging us up. It also lights up the hippocampus, an area of the brain responsible for making memories that last. It's one reason we remember vivid details of alarming situations. Rick's brain, lit up by norepinephrine, is extremely efficient, thinking clearly and analyzing possibilities and options nearly at light speed. If the infection spreads, he's worse than dead, Rick thinks, and scans for the axe. That leg needs to come off. And so it does, thanks to a remarkable process that allows amazing decisions to be made in the blink of an eye. You walk outside. You risk your life. You take a drink of water. You risk your life. Nowadays you breathe and you risk your life. You don't have a choice. The only thing you can choose is what you're risking it for. Herschel Green. The psychology of fear. Humans experience a range of emotions, but there are four that are the primary building blocks of the others. Happiness, sadness, anger, and fear. The Walking Dead allows fleeting moments of happiness. A baby found safe, a reunion, an unexpected kindness. But also offers plenty of the negative emotions. Tremendous sadness and grief, righteous and unrighteous anger, and plentiful fear. Sadness is usually the product of loss and is rooted in the past. After your dear father gets his head cut off by a sword-swinging governor, you get sad. When a fat zombie eats your dead wife's body, you get angry. But fear occupies a special place in our psychology. We experience it when we perceive a threat in the future, sometimes the very imminent future. Something bad may happen. A zombie may bite us. Cannibals may eat us. These things have yet to occur, but the perceived likelihood of the threat moves fear along a continuum from anxiety to panic. We feel anxious at the thought of zombies in the woods near the farm. We feel panic when they overrun the property. Even after a dreadful thing happens to us, such as getting bitten by a zombie in a prison corridor, we still feel fear. Why? Because we fear something worse might happen. Herschel would be afraid of having his calf muscle torn out by a hungry walker, but he would be more afraid of turning into a walker himself. The anxiety of searching through the dark hallway where something bad might happen gives way to the panic of knowing that something bad already has happened that may lead to an even worse thing happening. Over the course of the event, everyone's fear gets ratcheted up from anxiety and dread to full-blown panic. Humans, like other mammals, have remarkably efficient biological systems that help keep us alive even in the face of serious threats. But very much unlike other mammals, humans also have a highly sophisticated prefrontal cortex that allows us to recognize what many of these threats mean for us in the long term. We realize that death is inevitable, despite our best efforts to keep ourselves safe. Even before the outbreak, we live with this tension daily, in which we have a biological imperative to stay alive, coupled with the awareness that death will come to all of us. Many characters on The Walking Dead wrestle with this deeper notion that death is around the corner, while they also want to stay alive and hold on to reasons for living. This includes Maggie and Glenn, the young couple who found love in a hopeless place. Maybe it's that sense of love that makes them yearn for more than just survival, more than just freedom from fear. Maggie, I don't want to be afraid of being alive. Glenn, being afraid is what has kept us alive. Maggie, no, it's how we kept breathing. Like us, they both have the biological drive to stay alive, yet they know they are going to die. Maggie doesn't just want to breathe. She wants to live fully and to have reasons to live even in the landscape of the zombie apocalypse. To cope with the impossible dilemma of fighting to preserve a life we know will end one day, a psychological theory called TMT, Terror Management Theory, suggests that we turn to bigger and more permanent concepts and ideals, such as identifying with a faith system, being a member of a specific country or community, or being an artist or scientist or anything else that suffuses meaning into our lives in a way that will outlast us. In turn, we commit deeply to these ideals and punish those who challenge them. We form groups that help us survive and that share our values and our outlook on the world. We see this all the time in The Walking Dead. Fierce tribalism and closely knit communities evolve with, if you're not with us, you're against us, thinking, whether it is within the prison walls, the deceptively idyllic Woodbury, or Terminus, the trap at the end of the tracks. Each of these communities develops its own unique worldview, albeit bizarre and horrifying at times. The governor has created a seemingly safe haven in Woodbury that promises peace and protection, but his charismatic demeanor quickly comes unglued when he feels threatened by Rick and the others. Nothing will stand between him and his right to recline in front of a bunch of heads in jars. Later, in Terminus, the once good Gareth, presumably a version of Chris from the comic book series, having been terrorized by a gang of violent men, has concluded that you are either the hunter or the prey, and so he persuades his entire community to turn to cannibalism as a means of survival and domination. Join us or feed us, he tells subsequent newcomers. Gareth and his people become so callous to the murder and consumption of their fellow humans that they talk casually about mundane things as they stand over victims they intend to slaughter by cracking their skulls with baseball bats and slitting their throats. Later, he cuts off, cooks, and eats Bob Stuckey's leg in front of a man, the way Chris treats Dale in the comics. He's beyond depraved, but entirely congruent and accepted within his own community. TMT suggests that although we don't always commit to ideals or worldviews that are morally good or lovely, we do hold strong views designed to outlast us. Whether Gareth